views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to another night of Race Treaty. Tonight, a very important second part to the broadcast, confronting the silence, perspectives, and dialogue on structural racism against people of African descent worldwide, part two. And this is a very important convergence, and I'm speaking of the decade for those of African descent that's happening globally, the convergence of CERD, the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, an international law that the United States has signed treaty to that is more protective of human rights vis-a-vis racism in referencing disparate outcomes and disproportionalities as triggers. The Civil Rights Framework, which is intentionality. Can you prove intent to discriminate? And what's more important in this conversion is not only the global decade, the CERD, and now the movement, Black Lives Matter. And we've been hopeful, and really this is the reason why Race Treaty was launched, to hopefully follow and support this potential convergence. And that is going to be the remaining question that we'll be addressing next week in response to this tonight's broadcast, which is Black Lives Matter now going to become a human rights movement? Are we going to take it to the next level in terms of critical mass around all of these statistics and headlines every day that are human rights violations? And so the Black Lives Matter can expand and in actuality box in this political co-opting process that's underway. I understand also that now there's some liberal left-wing funding sources that are approaching Black Lives Matter to fund them to take their protests to the next level. And with money comes co-opting. So that is something is yet to be seen, just as we hopefully will see Black Lives Matter embrace the human rights movement and become just that. Scotty, can you kick in the second half? And we'll see you next week. This is a very important dialogue. Hear the message.
Students who acquire the necessary academic training, admission is denied. Even with admission, one is not guaranteed acceptance into the faculty of choice because of limited spaces. Higher education hence becomes a tool of discrimination that guards the society's stratification because poorer and working class families do not have the means to supplement student education to gain necessary access to the university system. Jamaica's limited resources and educational modalities lead to a host of social problems such as high employment, increased crime and violence, which disproportionately affect the majority Afro-descended population. The problems are deep-rooted, but we're also at a turning point with both Brazilians and Jamaicans, as both countries and the peoples have the socio-political knowledge and a desire to confront these challenges. Two vectors of proven change have to be implemented. One, more democratization of education, and of course, building self-sufficient economic communities from the grassroots level. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now to continue our discussion of the Caribbean and Latin America, please welcome Ramona Hernandez, who is the director of CUNY Dominican Studies Institute and professor of sociology at the City College of New York.
Muchas gracias. Thank you. I'd like to thank Ms. Kelly Onimba for this invitation. Discrimination against Black people of African descent in Latin America is historical. It goes way back to the first day Black Africans were bought, sold, and brought by force by their owners to a land they knew nothing about. Enslaved African Blacks entered into America Latina as a commodity, whose only value consisted in their capacity and ability to produce profit to enrich others, those who own them. Too many African Blacks perished in America Latina, converted into commodity. Those who own Black people in Latin America had no intention of treating Black who survived differently as equals, to integrate them into society as bona fide members. It was more. The children of Blacks have no better fate. They too had a price which, as their parents, was lower than the price of white children, the future owners of Black Latin American people. It is in La Española, a small island in the Caribbean, where this human devalorization of African Blacks in the Americas began. The system that devalued Blacks as people and valued them only as a commodity that generated the enrichment of others would spread throughout the Americas, and the Spaniard conquistadores, owners of Black people, would be joined by Portuguese conquistadores, English conquistadores, French conquistadores, and Dutch conquistadores. Each of these groups would erect their own version of a social economic system that had in common a perception of Black people and a way of treating them. The common perception about Blacks was ideological, and as such, it permeated all institutions of society where racial inequality existed. Institutional discrimination is a structural discrimination. It is something that does not happen one day, that is perpetrated by one. A structured racism is ingrained in society's social fabric, in people's blood, flesh, and souls, and it is perpetrated every day, all the time, systematically, in different ways, from overt to camouflaged manifestations. And as scholar Frank Fanon demonstrated years ago, way too many Blacks born within this system learn to value themselves through the system that devalued them, that considered and treated them as less. And this view... Gracias. And this view of themselves made many Black accomplices of their perpetrators. But oppression breeds resistance. And it is in the same island of La Española where African enslavement began in the Americas, where Blacks began to resist, to fight back. They began to undermine and challenge racism on the same day racial discrimination started against them in that island. This is to say that an ideology based on an alleged inferiority of Blacks did not penetrate all Blacks in America Latina. Did not manage to break all Blacks. There were Blacks who were not alienated from themselves, their history, their culture, and their legacy. Of course not. In fact, I argue that a systematic and long resistance is what explains the survival of the Black African legacy today in the Dominican Republic, a country that shares the island of La Española with the Republic of Haiti. Dominican historiography documents that Trujillo's Hispanic white state ideology did not take a hold of Dominican society as he has expected. Trujillo's ideology confronted disdain, people who continue to do their thing despite the fact that disobeying the Iron Fist regime could cost dissenters their lives. From the 1930s to the 1950s, intellectuals and medical doctors reported to Trujillo that Dominicans were practicing Black religious rites and that they were playing and dancing to the rhythms of African drums. Informants penetrated these groups incognitos. In their reports to Trujillo, the expert concluded that Dominicans were mentally ill, suffering from delusion. They also determined Dominicans were submerged in cultural ignorance. And Trujillo acted against that, all that that was African black in the Dominican Republic. Dominican blackness then remained practiced behind Trujillo's back, changing from overt pride to subversive immodesty. Dissident Dominicans surreptitiously protected their black cultural legacy and secured its arrival as long as Trujillo was in power. And afterwards, when Trujillo's sinister collaborator and successor, Presidente Joaquín Balaguer, took power and furthered the anti-black state policy designed by his predecessor. A way to undermine and dismantle structural racism today, an ill that persists despite monumental government legislation against it, is precisely by acknowledging that resistance, by speaking about these subversive actions on the part of black predecessors, by de-victimizing blacks and recognizing their victories, their standing up to evil social structures in societies in America Latina. My New York-born and raised son learned to be proud of himself from his grandparents, all Dominican immigrants who were also conscious of a social structure that fed all kinds of inequalities and devalued some people while overvaluing others. They had a history of clandestine resistance, a resistance and a pride that may have not been articulated in formal theoretical forms or expressed in government legislation, but that were passed to me and then to my son. The decade of the Afro-descendant should pay close attention to the history of struggle and resistance and to the history of cultural victory, endurance, and transmission. It should expand the narratives that speak of the multiple actions black undertook in their struggles to remain, to be unbroken, to keep their legacy to be, despite systematic attempts against them. The faces and the names of the protagonists of these struggles should be undusted and written in new history books that understand and portray blacks as people who may have given up and as people who never did. The history of resistance and cultural endurance is encapsulated in the traditions practiced for centuries by the average people, by the many groups that systematically went on in their marginalized and forgotten urban and rural spaces. They have been preserving their black African essence with our approval and resources provided by either the national elite or the Dominican state. It is these warriors, these agents of historical and cultural preservation, who have continued to act on their own, supported by their local communities, who, though unseen by the untrained foreign eyes, who may only see what he or she has learned to see in his or her own society, are very real to the Dominican people. The Afro-descendant decade should document this cultural resistance, to support these who, without massive support and tons of money behind them, have done what needs to be done to ensure that my son's black African legacy remains in him and in the future generations of his descendants once I nor him are no longer in this world. Muchas gracias.
Thank you so much. So we now move north into North America. Stephen W. Hawkins is the Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. His deep and personal experience in grassroots advocacy, fundraising, youth engagement, and membership mobilization empowers his fight for human rights on a global scale. We welcome his empowering message to our program of action here today.
Thank you all, and thank you to the High Commissioner and honored guests. Amnesty International took to the streets in Ferguson and in Baltimore because we recognized the human rights crises that were unfolding here in the United States with respect to police use of force against citizens, and particularly black youth. What we recognize is that the police here in the United States are relatively ungoverned in terms of their use of force. Amnesty, as a result of being on the ground in Ferguson and Baltimore, undertook a study, a 50-state study of of the laws on the books in every state within the United States. What we found was shocking. 9 states had no law codified whatsoever with respect to how the police should use lethal force in any given situation. None of the states met the standards prescribed by the international community. And as a result, we've put together some model legislation that comports with international standards, and I'm pleased to announce that Maryland and a few other states are looking at adopting law, Maryland being one of those states that had no law at all on the books, and hopefully will adopt the standards that Amnesty has put forth. What we face in terms of policing in the United States is extraordinary in terms of the fact that we have 18,000 local jurisdictions, totally atomized, totally decentralized, so that 4 deputies in some small town can determine whether someone lives or dies on any particular day. That is outrageous. And when I look at the national response to the crisis after 9/11, when we had in this country, in the United States, thousands of local airports, big ones like JFK, but also small regional airports in rural areas and so forth. But within 1 year, the federal government was able to act and create TSA and do something about this totally decentralized approach to airline security. Well, I believe that we face another crisis in this country, and that's the crisis of how black youth are treated by the police in this country. And if the federal government can respond to one crisis, it can respond to this one. And I think the families of Tamir Rice, of Eric Gardner, of Michael Brown, of Andrew Joseph, and so many others call for this government, call for the United States government to react to this crisis in the same way. Thank you.
Now we hear a tragic personal story which represents far too many such stories around the world. Samaria Rice, on November 22, 2014, her youngest son, Tamir Rice, 12, was fatally shot by Cleveland police in Ohio. Since that time, Samaria has been engaged in a campaign to provide justice for her son's death. Her life is dedicated to assisting children everywhere who suffer from official violence. Please welcome Samaria Rice.
You can do it. It's just a mirror for your neighbor. You can do it. You can do it. Take your time. You got all the time you need. Take your time.
Hello, everyone. I'm here today along with John Crawford Jr. and Andrew and Deanna Joseph Jr. Our children are victims of police brutality. My son, Tamir Rice, was 12 years old. Tamir was shot and killed less than 2 seconds by Cleveland, Ohio police officer Timothy Lohman. I want the world to know that letting a child outside to play and never to return home is a mother and father's nightmare. Tamir was a bright, loving child who was very talented in many ways. Tamir was a member of the Boys and Girls Club. Tamir played many sports. Tamir loved animals and arts and crafts. as well. Tamir was the glue to keep our family flowing with love and laughter. Every morning I wake up, I think of Tamir, but also I wake up looking for change across this nation. I wake up seeking justice for my son, and that's why I'm here today. Okay.
You're doing great. Okay.
I would like to thank the United Nations for allowing me to speak. I want to thank Bruce Knox and Greg Greer, my team of attorneys, and my family and friends, and a special thanks to my Uncle Mike, who's here with me today. May God bless this nation and this world. Thank you.
Thank you. Pulling grieving mothers together, Nicole Lee is General Counsel for Mothers Against Police Brutality. She is a highly respected human rights lawyer and thought leader. She is presently working with the Organization of American States Inter-American Commission on Human Rights Initiative on police use of excessive force in the United States. Please welcome this champion of justice.
Thank you, Chairman Knox, and all of those that organized this important gathering. I am Nicole Lee. I'm a Washington-based attorney specializing in human rights. But today I am speaking in my capacity as senior advisor to Mothers Against Police Brutality. Mothers Against Police Brutality was founded by Colette Flanagan after a Dallas police officer shot her son, Clinton Allen, to death on March 10, 2013. Clinton, a 25-year-old African-American father of two, was unarmed when he was shot seven times. There were no charges brought in this official homicide. No indictment, no prosecution, no trial, no loss of pay for the officer, no punishment of any kind. It was out of this experience of unaccountable police violence that Mothers Against Police Brutality was formed. Our work is grounded in the lived experience of mothers and families who have lost their loved ones to police brutality. We seek to unite these mothers and families nationwide in positive action for change. By assisting families, Mothers Against Police Brutality, we try to lift up their authentic voice, too often the missing voice, and the national conversation about police violence against the public. The purposes of Mothers Against Police Brutality are to stop the killing of unarmed and mentally ill persons by law enforcement agencies, particularly the killing of Black and Latino men and women, and to change deadly force policies and practices. In pursuit of these goals, we employed the full range of citizen action strategies, letter writing, face-to-face meetings with public officials, legislative testimony, vigils, marches, development of model policies, legal action, and coalition building with other national and local groups. Additionally, we seek specific steps to make our police departments more accountable to the public. These are specific steps that focus on the pressure points surrounding police killings and brutality that include special prosecutors to replace the ineffective and compromised district attorney investigations, timely drug testing of officers, psychological evaluation and cultural competence of officers, and compensation for victims' families. Use of body cameras, and standardized deadly force training approved by the Federal Justice Department. Also, reevaluation of the criteria for civil rights violations in police shootings and a national database of problem officers. I would like to close with brief reflections on the role of women in this current movement. We are the backbone, the strategists, and the visionaries of the movement against police brutality. We are the leaders, the organizers, and the foot soldiers. Mothers and daughters of the most affected play an invaluable role in these struggles for justice across the globe, not just in the United States. In Argentina, for example, the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo played a strategic role in the movement against fascism, demanding justice for their children that were killed and maimed during the Dirty War. Today, women are battling displacement, unjust evictions, and sexual assault in post-earthquake Haiti. In the Dominican Republic, civil society, women leaders fight against anti-blackness and state violence through policies that render Dominicans of Haitian descent stateless. And in the United States, black women have always played a crucial role in the fight against anti-black racism. Whether it was Ida B. Wells in anti-lynching campaigns, the organizing and civil disobedience of Rosa Parks, or the strategic planning of Diane Nash, the roles that women have played were crucial to the victories that have been won across centuries. Today, as then, in the spirit of Mamie Till, mothers who have lost their children put aside their profound grief and take up the cause for the benefit of all mothers and children. Countless women who may never be interviewed by the media are leading and sustaining the movement for change locally and nationally. Even within our government, we see that black women are playing an important part in reform. But we at Mothers Against Brutality, Mothers Against Police Brutality, know that reforming the system is simply not enough. Mothers and family members know all too well that reforming police forces does not eradicate state violence. It is just one of the many manifestations of structural racism that keeps people of African descent from achieving our full potential. Thank you.
One champion woman who responds to the indifference of black lives is Alicia Garza. She's an organizer, writer, and freedom dreamer. She is the co-creator of hashtag Black Lives Matter, a national organizing project focused on combating anti-black state-sanctioned violence. Alicia's work challenges us to celebrate the contributions of black queer women's work within popular narratives of black movements and reminds us that the black radical tradition is long, complex, and international. Please welcome Alicia Garza as she reminds us that Black Lives Matter.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, UN. And thank you for all of you for coming and being here this afternoon. I start by saying that anti-black racism saturates every aspect of our society in the United States. In a country where black bodies were amongst the first currency in our economy, and where black people are counted as three-fifths of a human being for the purposes of apportioning power to those who owned other people and away from those who were owned, it's hard to find any system, any structure, any policy, or practice that's advanced by the United States that is not steeped in our violent origins. In 2014, black people were 13.2% of our total population, yet this year alone, 960 people were killed by the police, with black people being twice as likely to be killed than whites or Latinos. According to the Malcolm X grassroots movement, every 28 hours in this country, a black person is murdered by police, security guards, or vigilantes. While black men are more likely to be killed by the police, black women are more likely to experience sexual violence at the hands of those who are sworn to protect and serve us. Over the last 10 years, women in prisons has increased by 138%. 90% of those women are single mothers and often lose contact with their children forever. In fact, we are the fastest growing prison population in the United States. The majority of women who are locked up commit what we call quote-unquote crimes of survival or economic crimes. In fact, 80% of these women earn less than $2,000 a year at the time of their arrest. Black women are 3 times more likely than white women to be single heads of households with children under the age of 18. More than 21 transgendered women, most of whom were black, have been reported murdered since the beginning of 2015, though so many are not reported, and when they are reported, they are misgendered. The average life expectancy of a black transgender woman is 35 years old, and that is due to both murder and poverty. Our mothers are being robbed of the ability to see our children grow up, become adults, and perhaps even have families of our own. We are half the prison population in a country that incarcerates more people than anywhere else in the world. Black women make 64 cents to every 78 cents that white women make to every dollar that a white man makes. Generations of structural racism have burdened black communities with overwhelming debt. And today, while the typical white household is worth $141,900, the typical black household in the United States is worth $11,000. 1 in 13 black people born in the United States is unable to vote because of felony convictions, and lawmakers in our country continue to pass restrictive covenants that deny black people access to a robust democracy. There are 500,000 undocumented black immigrants within the borders of the United States who are both being criminalized for being undocumented and criminalized for being black. For black people, especially those of us who exist at the intersections of gender, class, citizenship status, and sexuality, it is a daily struggle to simply live while black, much less thrive while black. The United States has failed to adequately and robustly engage in truthful and honest reconciliation as it relates to the persistence, prevalence, and dire consequences of anti-black racism. Any best practices or recommendations must be grounded in the willingness of the United States to admit that there is still a war on people of African descent. We question the ability of this nation state to remain united when people of African descent are excluded, marginalized, disenfranchised, and murdered with impunity. And this misery is all sanctioned by the state. We agree with our allies at the Malcolm X grassroots movement that we need a comprehensive national plan of action for racial justice that looks at how to address the stark disparities facing people of African descent in America. We can drastically reduce the population of people of color and specifically black people in prisons and jails by addressing disparities in our criminal system and in our economic system, paying particular attention to sentencing and diversion, investing in community programs that are culturally relevant, and interrupting bias with judges, prosecutors, district attorneys, and of course the police. We must end the drug war as a part of ending the war on black communities. An end to the criminalization of poverty and the militarization of civil society will go a long way in protecting the sanctity of black life. A social wage is required to ensure that all families have access to dignity in this country. A more robust democracy with no barriers to access to it can only be achieved by the enfranchisement of black people, which means enfranchising former felons and currently incarcerated people and prohibiting any restrictions to access to democracy. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, we must ensure that adequate resources are reinvested in black communities that have been devastated by deinvestment. Reparations for the slave trade, but also reparations. Let us say that again. Reparations for the slave trade, but also reparations for the wealth that has been deliberately stolen from people of African descent is an important and a relevant advance. This is an important and relevant advance, especially in the context of predatory lending, subprime mortgages, and the gentrification that has ravaged black communities for the last 6 decades. Let this decade be the one where Black people throughout the diaspora are seen as the solutions, the future to the sanctity of this world, rather than problems to be fixed. Thank you.
Well, I don't know how we're going to follow that. We're going to move to Europe. Europe's not quite so exciting, but maybe I'm wrong. Christian Aluna is the executive director of the International Legal Assistance Consortium, an umbrella organization for a number of international associations of judges, prosecutors, and lawyers with the objective of resurrecting judicial systems in post-conflict areas. Please welcome our final speaker, Christian Aluna.
Thank you, Mr. Knox. Yes, I'm afraid this will be quite a change of scenery, which I will describe now. First of all, let me say how deeply honored I am on behalf of the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance, better known as ECRI, to be invited to this important event and to be able to talk to you about the work that this commission is doing to counter racism and racial discrimination against people of African descent in Europe. Anti-Black racism exists all over Europe. But before I go into the specifics of that, please let me briefly describe to you what ECRI is and how we are working. ECRI is a body within the Council of Europe, not to be confused with the European Union, which is quite confusing even for Europeans. But ECRI consists of a representative of all the 47 member countries of the European Union. And those are experts in their own personal capacity. They do not act on behalf of their governments. We monitor on an ongoing basis how the European Convention for Human Rights is implemented by the various nations as far as the provisions to combat racism and intolerance. We issue reports, recommendations, and follow-up for this purpose. And in reality, we visit every country and issue a report about every fifth year. In addition to that monitoring exercise, we also, when there is a need, we publish so-called general policy recommendations. And for the relevance of today's topics, we have published one such recommendation on combating racism in the field of sport and one on combating racism in policing. Those recommendations are directed to provide guidance to legislators and policy makers in the member countries. Moving on then to concrete expressions of anti-Black racism and discrimination in Europe, I would like to group that into three groupings. There is much more to say, but I know that the time is limited, so I will have to concentrate on the most serious violations. The first category concerns hate speech. And here we have the most visible anti-Black racism in Europe, and that is in the field of sports. And particularly in the field of professional soccer. More and more black players qualify to be members of the elite professional teams in Europe. And as they travel to towns in other countries, they very often suffer serious racial discrimination and insults. I won't go into the concrete expressions of that, but it's heartbreaking sometimes to see how the public, how the audiences treat and insult individual black players who are, of course, also quite, I mean, they're in a very small minority often in their teams. That was the reason why we published this general policy recommendation, how to combat racism in sport. This is mostly seen in Eastern European countries where they have a smaller black population than in the West, but we also see it in countries like Belgium and Italy. Another area which under the hate speech category is racism against politicians. We've seen that recently both in France and in Italy. In France, a black woman was recently nominated cabinet minister for justice, which triggered terrible comments in the far-right press and among far-right political parties, expressions that would never be tolerated in this country, I'm convinced. And similarly in Italy, where the Minister for Migration is a woman who originated in the Democratic Republic of Congo and who has been very much insulted and badly treated in her country by far-right circles. We also see a rise of anti-black racism on the internet. The judicial or the legal regulatory framework in Europe to battle to battle hate speech is quite well developed, but on the internet it's not implemented at all, and the internet is an area where right wing extremists can exercise their racism with impunity. And that is something that we are also very much concerned about. Hate speech, of course, typically triggers racial violence. And that is something that we're seeing more and more in Europe today. Much of it as a consequence of the growing refugee crisis and the backlash that that is creating among many in parts of the population. This can, for example, manifest itself on attacks on refugee reception centers, but also against violence against individuals in public places. Greece saw a dramatic spike in the number of racist attacks between 2012 and 2014 as violence organized by the neo-Nazi party Golden Dawn, which targeted refugees and asylum seekers and among those many blacks who were present at the time in the center of Athens. It's very difficult. We try to gather statistics about racist violence and other and similar occurrences, but it's very difficult because many of the people who are being subjected to this kind of violence do not want to or do not dare to report these occurrences to the police. So we are convinced that for every report about racist violence, there are probably 10, 15, or 20 that are not being reported. And I should say that in this context, and when we talk about the legal framework, ECRI has a policy in every report, in every contact with every country, to recommend that countries in their criminal legislation should have provisions which would guarantee that racial hatred would, when you commit a crime, would be an aggravating circumstance. This leads me to my third category, and that is racial profiling in policing, and in that context also reports about black people who, when they report an incident of racial violence, they're often not being taken serious by the police. And even worse, sometimes the police itself perpetrates violence against those black people. So this has been the reason why ECRI has published a general policy recommendation to legislate and to implement to prevent racial profiling in policing. These occurrences of anti-black racism and discrimination is not going down. In the footsteps of the crisis, the refugee crisis, in contrast, we see a rise here. The work of this commission is not getting any easier, and I very much welcome the possibilities in our work to get ideas and cooperation with those other areas that we have been hearing from today. And I would also like to see the presence of my commission here today as an expression of solidarity with the Black Lives Matter. Thank you very much.
I've done a very poor job of keeping people to their time, and I actually wanted to have a father of a victim speak, and so John, if you wouldn't mind, John Crawford.
First of all, I'd like to say praise to the Most High for allowing me to be here in sound body and mind. Secondly, I would like to thank High Commissioner and the UN for having us. Thanks for the invite. I must be honest and say that there's a dichotomy that exists between my spirit right now, because I'm very gracious to be here, but at the same time I'm appalled. Because you know it's 2015 and we're regressing and not progressing. And I'll try to allow brevity to be my friend. My son, along with Tamir, his name was John Crawford III. He was killed in a Walmart last year on August the 5th, 4 days prior to Michael Brown and the situation in Ferguson manifested itself. It was essentially a prank call by a guy. He was swatted in criminal terms. That's what he was swatted, and they came and shot him within 0.33 one-hundredths of a second. So as you can imagine, you can't, that's literally the blink of an eye, you know. So you can imagine once we saw the footage, we were just overwhelmed. But keeping this thing in context, you know, I hear all of these great, the dialogue and the perceptions are on point, you know, but my background is in criminal justice as well. And my father served almost 30 years in the military. So I bounced around the globe with him and I was afforded the opportunity to eat different foods and talk to different people and get different perspectives and ideologies on certain things and methodologies. And I'm glad to be here in that regard because I get a chance to give homage to my African ancestors and comrades. Thank you for helping shaping my reasoning and rationale. I appreciate that. What do we do? The fundamental question that I'm asked as a father, and there's not many of us on the circuit. I'm here with Mr. Joseph, Andrew Joseph, and there's not many fathers on the circuit. What do we do when we see things? Why aren't we? I'm hoping that this is a platform for me personally, as well as Samaria and the parents, to utilize and apply pressure, if you will, to the system, because we can sit here and have dialogue all day, and it's great. We need to have it. It's definitely needed. However, if you know the problem, what do you do to combat the problem? What is the resolution? How do we get together and apply pressure? And my argument was, until you have an equalitarian agenda, you know, we can't expect the oppressor to help the oppressed. our condemnation is our contentment. We've got to stop being so content. When we can look at footage and see someone lose their lives unjustly, within a fraction, literally, I believe my son's killed is the fastest on the planet, 0.33/100. So that's the forensic background, 0.33/100 of a second. Okay, Tamir, 2 seconds. You know, not a chance to even you can't process anything that fast, much less talk about it. But then you hear the same stories with the officers involved saying, well, I felt threatened for my life. They have misused. The law is the law, and it's there. The Fourth Amendment is clear to me, you know. But what is reasonable in the court of law? That's a relative term, you know. But it was still, when we look at that aspect of it, when we look at the jargon, if you will, because this is how they're getting off. You want to know how? This is how. They're saying, what is reasonable? When the prosecutor is going in there to prosecute, he said, well, what is reasonable? Okay. Well, that's in there. That's in the language. However, the reasonableness is still predicated on something called imminent risk and danger. So you must be at imminent risk or danger first before something is found reasonable. And this is the thing that we're not addressing, frankly. So I would like to figure out a way to use the UN as a platform to apply pressure. When you're disproportionate in numbers, as we are in government, as we are, when you don't have enough blacks, and I'm not talking in there to leverage, if you will, the playing field, how do you expect to get results? We can talk until we're blue in the face, and until we become equal where the power structure is, the infrastructure, it's going to be business as usual. You know, and so that's my plea. That's the primary purpose that I'm here, is to try to figure out, to form alliances. You know, when you're economically disproportionate, you don't have any power. You're powerless. What do you do? We know what the problem is. All of the speakers prior to myself so eloquently stated a lot of the problems and some of the solutions. But now I ask, how do you go the implementation of those solutions? What do we do? Do we get in a closed room along with legislation? And what do we do from that point? I'm just a clear-cut guy, you know, so I need clear-cut answers, you know. It sounds good. It sounds great. But What can we do about that? You know, that's the primary reason I'm here, is to form some alliances and hope to use this as a platform to move forward in how we can apply pressure to the system so we can stop some of this madness that's going on with police. And I'll, in summation here, I'll sum it up here. One of the things, and I agree with you, Samaria, until there are proper sanctions given, it's going to be business as usual. You know, and I declare, I say, we are on the verge of a civil war here, and I'm trying to figure out, along with yourself, all of this intelligence in the room right now, all the diplomats, all the intelligence, a lot of the powers right here in this room right now. What do we do to combat this civil war? In real language, you know, what do we do to implement a strategy that says, okay, you cannot take anyone's life. You must follow the Fourth Amendment in its practices. You must follow the law in its practices. And if you do not, these are the sanctions. And until you give these officers, until you give the system sanctions, there must be sanctions given. I can't stress that enough, because this is the reason they're killing with impunity. It's not by chance that they're saying, well, you know, if there was some sanctions given, obviously they would think about it. You know, the same way that civilians think about it. The only reason that there's not a flat out war between civilians and law enforcement right now is, frankly, we think about it. There's a fear mechanism in there that says, hey, if I kill this cop, I'm either going they're going to impose lethal injection, or I'm going to prison for the rest of my life without the possibility of parole, both of which are death sentence, in my opinion. So I just simply would like to pose that as a question, and hopefully use this as a platform to make that happen, make that a realization. Thank you for having me. I thank you for your time.
Be sure to check the link for the rest of this webcast from the UN. The link is on our tonight's show's page. Be sure to do that. This is some dynamic conversation going on about this international ability to impose international law. Tune in next week and we'll dissect this, chop it up. Good night. Peace. Upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. Our things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby.